Give me a chance to present some of the work that we've done at the University of Waterloo on spinices and its quantum cousin. I'm not exactly sure why I'm in this entangled session. If anything, maybe I should have been lumped in the emergence. But at any rate, what I'd like to do is to actually, this talk is going to be quite different than pretty much what you've heard over the last 2 days. It's not high-level theory. And the main agenda is to relate maybe to experiments in the context of seeking some kind of emerging gauge theory systems. And so I'll walk you through on this. So really the scope maybe is motivated at large by a series of papers that span the last 7 years or so, where the idea is that in frustrated systems which have a classical constrained ground state, that you can have, when you quantize the systems, you can have emerging QED on the lattice with deconfined quasi-particles like spinons and monopoles and emerging light. And so one of the questions would be, notwithstanding the high interest in these theoretical work and even some numerical work that has been done using QMC on Hamiltonian that do not have a sign problem, the question is, are there archetype materials for which this kind of physics can be explored and where these emergent photons could be seen and so on. And so the idea is that generically maybe these kind of theories have in the temperature and some kind of tunable parameters a generic phase diagram where you have some kind of deconfined or disordered phase where the quasi-particle, the excitation lab classically what you might call a Coulomb phase, or when you quantize a Maxwell phase and a confined ordered phase, that's a nail ordered phase. And so this is maybe a topic which is for some of people in the audience not familiar with. There are two papers which are closely related that discuss that appeared within the last 5 years or so. So what's interesting is that both of these field theory papers motivate that the onset of their work, a model, an effective theory, which starts from a frustrated, I'll explain what I mean later, this is really frustrated spin system in the standard sense, frustrated classical Ising spins, but where there is a term in the Hamiltonian, in the effective Hamiltonian, which is non-commuting with the first one, and which is responsible for quantum dynamics. And starting from this premise, then through a number of plausible argument, one can is led to suggest that the theory of these systems is described by 3 plus 1 QED on the lattice, where these the properties of this Maxwell phase emerge. So the real question I have is, can we find such an effective Hamiltonian like this in materials which are currently accessible within the field of frustrated magnetism? Okay, so the idea is, from a material point of view, is a bit the same as contextually from what the theorists have done. What has been done by Hermelake and Castromeditron co-workers is to start from a classical system which has an extensive entropy and then add on in a perturbative manner the quantum fluctuations. So the idea is maybe one can follow the same kind of process experimentally. Can we start from a materials which has this classical type of extensive degeneracy, and then seek in the proximity of that family of material system for which the quantum dynamics is kind of turned on in some kind of controlled manner. Okay, so this is so these are the actors in the materials wise in what I will talk about. They are these so-called rare earth power cores. They are real materials for which the first two are classical Ising, frustrated Ising spin systems. They have a Coulomb phase with the emerging gauge charges. This has been reported over the last 8 months or so in papers in Science and Nature that I'll briefly review in this talk. And then the tritium titanate would be this quantum cousin where the effective theory of the low energy theory of this material would be the starting XXZ model from which the field theory works start with. So the idea is that possibly terbium titanate or other terbium variants of these materials might be candidates to seek these interesting phenomena. Whether or not this is the situation is a subject to experimental investigation. Okay, so I'd like to acknowledge a number of collaborators. Pauli Fassi is a postdoc in my group. Amit Manavian was a PhD student, and Tara Sarovsky was a postdoc. And we have collaborated with Steve Branwell and Tom Tenoch to experiment this at UCL in London. So the outline is the following. So first, some very old stuff. I'll go extremely fast here because this is pretty old by now. This is our comment on what are the spin ices. So these are these classical systems. Then I'll talk about the recent developments that are of experimental nature, where this Coulomb phase and the divergence free field, this description of the spin correlation in the system has been exposed experimentally, and then talk about the spin liquid phase of the terbium packaging as a system that might be described by an effective XXZ model. Okay, so in conventional classical Ising anti-formula, frustration arises when you have triangles or tetrahedra and you have vertices, you have a spin, an Ising spin that resides at each side, and if you have a nearest neighbor anti-formatic interaction on such a network, then you have frustration, and you, depending on the structure, you can satisfy two of the three bounds or four, but you have a number of the interactions which are not satisfied, and one refers to a situation like that as a geometrical frustration. Okay, so the materials that I was mentioning earlier, the holmium piconate and the sposium piconate, are the crystalline structures are cubic, so one cannot really talk about a global Ising direction, so one refers to local Ising direction, and these local Ising directions are the directions that go from the magnetic side and points in the unit cell, the primitive unit cell in the tetrahedron. So these Ising spins in the holmium and sposium piconate are classical binary variables which can be plus one or minus one, indicating that the magnetic moments point in or out of the tetrahedron. Okay, so for what's interesting in this material, so the first interesting aspect of it is that the interaction between these materials are ferromagnetic. So according to the standard law, these systems shouldn't be frustrated, but this essentially infinite Ising constraints of the spins pointing in and out is what endows these materials to have frustration. I'll explain that in a second. Okay, so we start from an Hamiltonian where the interaction between nearest neighbor is of this type. And the convention here is that the positive exchange would be ferromagnetic and not frustrated, and negative exchange would be anti-ferromagnetic. But the constraints that the spin must point along these local z hat directions, where the sigmas are plus or minus one, can be injected into this Hamiltonian. And one finds that because the scalar product of these Ising directions is minus one third, then there's a swapping of the sign in front, and one would get this Hamiltonian here. So, from a point of view of these materials, the interactions are actually frustrated when the exchange interaction is ferromagnetic and not anti-ferromagnetic. Okay. So, but from a point of view of the statistical mechanics, these materials, the only systems with Ising spins have the same partition function as the anti-ferromagnetic model with the same anti-ferromagnetic exchange. So they are a frustrated system and have an expensive entropy. Okay, so if the exchange is ferromagnetic, they are on a single tetrahedron, there are six ground states that correspond to two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out. And if the exchange is anti-ferromagnetic, they are not frustrated, and the ground state corresponds to all the spins pointing in or all the spins pointing out. And so this problem where the exchange is anti-ferromagnetic is rather trivial. There is a global broken symmetry ground state which corresponds to an Ising phase. So the one unit cell, one primitive unit cell that's a disk tetrahedron, can have all the spins pointing in and all the spins pointing out. And upon cooling the system, there's a second order phase transition in the Ising universality class to one of these two ground states. So the situation I want to talk about, which is the one that is realized experimentally, is when the interaction between the spins is ferromagnetic and therefore frustrated. Okay, so
So there's an infinite number of such classical ground states that satisfy the minimum energy constraints, and the situation is that on each tetrahedron you must have two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out, and these are called the ice rules because they are identical to the ice rules in water ice, as I explained in a second. Okay, let me skip that for now. So one can do a back of envelope calculation similar to what actually Linus Pauling did for water ice and estimate how many ground states there are in the system of n spins. So there are n over 4 tetrahedra. And so the leading order estimate for what is the number of ground states in the system is exponentially larger than the number of spins. This number can be obtained in maybe half a dozen different ways. Procedurally, probably the easiest way to do it is to do the calculation on the Bethe lattice. So one finds that number of ground states is given by this formula here, and therefore the zero temperature entropy given by Kb times the log of this number is equal to what's in the square box there, Kb over 2 times log 3 half. So this entropy, this extensive residual, this extensive zero temperature entropy, is identical to what Linus Pauling calculated in 1935 for water ice, and furthermore is also what was experimentally measured by William Gauck and co-workers for real water ice. Okay, so because of this observation, these ferromagnetic powder materials have been coined the name spinices because they have the same entropy. But in fact, it's more interesting than that. In fact, the protons in water in the spinices, sorry, the spins in spinices are really like ice. So let me explain that. In water ice, you have H2O, you have an oxygen and two protons forming a water molecule, and there's something called the Bernard-Fowler ice rule. There are two ice rules, but the one that is important for us here is the second ice rule that says that if you want to think about water ice as a hydrogen-bonded crystal of water molecules, you should consider that for each oxygen, for each water molecule, there are two protons near to this oxygen, such that this water molecule is hydrogen bonded to these two oxygen, and there are two protons that are far, and therefore this water molecule here would be hydrogen bonded to this one, and similarly for this one here. So for the condition for the hexagonal structure of water ice, that there must be two protons near and two protons far, gives rise to an infinite number of ground states. And the log of these number of states gives you the residual Pauling entropy for water ice. Now what one can do is to represent the position of the protons here, not by the protons themselves, but by a displacement vector, which is sitting on the medial lattice, which lives on the midpoint between two oxygen. So these two protons that are near this oxygen can be represented by these two arrows that point towards this oxygen. And these two other protons, this guy and this guy, can be represented by these two arrows. And these arrows can be pointing in or out in reference to this tetrahedron, and therefore one has two in, two out arrows, or the spins. And then by putting together all these tetrahedra, we get that the ice rules in water ice are the ice rules for the spins, and spin ice is ice, and ice is spin ice. Okay, so for water ice, at least cubic ice, the partial function within this simple model, one might call that model the Pauling model, there is a one-to-one correspondence between the position or the configurational disorder of the protons in water ice and the spin directions in spin ice. They are identical. So this was demonstrated experimentally already more than 10 years ago now by Art Fanders and co-workers in an experiment where the magnetic specific heat was measured as a function of temperature. And through a thermodynamic integration, one can calculate what is the difference of entropy between two temperatures by doing the integration of C over T, the specific heat, divided by temperature times dT. And so the red curve here shows what is hidden here. It's C divided by T as a function of temperature. So there's no phase transition as would be signaled by sharp divergent or constant specific heat. So by integrating this curve here, one finds that by setting the constant of integration equal to zero here, one starts here smoothly, and the entropy climbs. And in the large temperature regime, if the system had a unique ground state, the total entropy one would recover would be log 2 because there's two accessible states per site. But this is not what we find, is that this entropy that is recovered is offset compared to log 2 by an amount which is within the 10% or so, this residual entropy, 1 half log 3 half. So what that means is that instead of starting integrating this entropy or the specific heat divided by temperature here and setting the constant of integration to 0, this whole curve should have been lifted up by this amount here, 1 half plus 3 half. But of course, that probably means you don't know. This is not how one proceeds experimentally. So this is the thermodynamic evidence that these materials truly possess an extensive residual entropy given by the Pauli residual entropy. Okay, so from a material point of view, from a physical point of view, the Hamiltonian, microscopic Hamiltonian, is a bit more complicated than what I told you. Not only there is an exchange interaction between nearest neighbor, but these holmium or dysprosium ions have a very, very large magnetic moment of the order of 10 Bohr magnetons. And so that gives rise to a very large long-range dipole, very strong long-range dipole interaction, which has to be included at the outset. And so this value of the exchange, the dipole interaction is known a priori from the properties of the ion. So this is the coupling constant here. What is not known is the exchange number, but this can be fitted, for example, from a high temperature to the expansion of the specific heat. One can obtain what is the value of J1. And so if one does that, one finds through a Monte Carlo simulation that the agreement between the experiments and the simulation is very good. So the open circle, red circle, see are the experimental data, and the triangular, the blue triangles are the Monte Carlo results, where the only adjusted parameter here is the exchange. So this, so from a microscopic theory point of view, the equilibrium properties of the spin ice materials is now in extremely good shape. One can calculate, refine this model and calculate bulk properties, and then take the crystals and do a neutron scattering, and with no adjustable parameter whatsoever, get all the details of all the scattering. Maybe that's not surprising, because these are classical Hamiltonian, and so they are amenable to massive, large-scale Monte Carlo simulations, and there's no sign problem. So we understand pretty much everything about the classical properties of these, the properties of these materials, because they are extremely Ising-like systems. So at low temperature, the ice rules are fulfilled, and one cannot, the low energy excitation of these systems are actually non-local excitations, which corresponds to flipping skins along closed loops, which allows an exploration of the low energy manifold of the system. And so if these kind of non-local loop moves are introduced in the Monte Carlo simulation, one finds that actually at low temperature, there is a phase transition, a first order phase transition to a long range order phase. So the way one should understand the spin ice regime in the system is really as a spin liquid. It's a classical spin liquid of sorts where the dynamics is extremely sluggish. So this bump here in the specific heat is really what separates a high temperature paramagnetic phase to what one might call a collective paramagnet. So below the peak in the specific heat here, the ice walls get enforced and fulfilled, and so a massive amount of entropy gets removed through this buildup of ice correlations, but ultimately at low temperature, they are a subset, 12 in fact, for the model that I just described, the ground states, the discrete-digit ground states, which have a slightly lower energy, and if dynamics can be preserved through non-local dynamics, non-local Monte Carlo moves, then there's a first order transition with the latent heat, and the entropy and the latent heat that is under the specific heat peak is equal to Pauli's entropy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have two questions. One is that little hexagon enough to walk through all configurations, or do you have to update over long loops?
Okay, so when we did that, that's already a long time ago, that was before this notion of topological sectors and everything was put forward and really came at the forefront. So presumably, if you only have short loop hexagons, you would not explore the whole manifold of states. And so there would be some issues there. For example, if you want to change the magnetization by some numbers, you have to have loops which are system spanning.
Mm-hmm.
But when we did the simulations, we allowed various variants of this loop moves, but all the loops that we we could have loops of arbitrary size, and we had loops that span the whole system.
But classically, that's okay because you can break a defect, and the defect walks. So that should be there should be some Arrhenius relaxation.
That's right.
And you observe that experimentally.
Yes. Experimentally, well, the issue experimentally of the relaxation. Yeah, it's. I'll comment on that in a second. It's not quite Arrhenius. It corresponds to. A condensation of these monopoles and is described by the Huckel type theory, just as an ionic fluid, in fact. So I'll come back to that in a second. Okay, so that was a brief view. So now the interesting state of these spin ice is actually the low temperature phase in the ice regime. So so the way one can describe this low temperature state is by a polarization type field, which is divergence free. So this field here imposes or implements the constraint that on each tetrahedron you have two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out. So on the ice rolls, the field is perfectly divergence free, but when the spin is flipped, there is a flux associated to these defects, and this flipping of the spins amount to a gauge charge associated to the system, which satisfies the Gauss's law. So let me illustrate that with a picture. So the ice rolls can be illustrated or viewed in terms of the spins themselves, that with two spins pointing in or pointing out, but as a construction which is is getting lots of mileage out of it, is to represent each of these spins by a charge where the head of the spin is a positive charge and the tail is a negative charge, and so the ice rules amount to having each center of the tetrahedron, which actually live on the diamond lattice, to be charge neutral, and so the diamond lattice, the center of the tetrahedron, is a neutral state when the ice rules are satisfied, and at large length scale, one can then make do. Without the spins all together, and only talk about the charges on the diamond lattice to describe the large length scale property of the systems. So the fluctuations of the spin ice manifolds that corresponds to a spin flip can be described as a creation of a charge, an ionic defect on the diamond lattice describing the system. So this is maybe. How one can see that. So if we have two adjoining tetrahedron, which are in a 2 in 2 out configuration, you have both tetrahedron fulfill the ice rules, but if a spin is split here, such that this tetrahedron is in a configuration of 1 in 3 out, and this one is in a 3 in 1 out, then you create these two defects, these two charges of opposite charge, and this is what it looks like if we make do without the spins themselves anymore. So this tetrahedron becomes a charge now with three blue charges. This tetrahedron becomes a charge of, let's say, plus Q, and this one becomes charge of minus Q, this panel corresponds to this one where the tetrahedron was charge neutral. So here you had two blue and two red, and here you had two blue and two red charges. But upon a spin flip that values the ice rule, this tetrahedron is now has a charge of one, a defect of one charge, and the adjoining tetrahedron have a defect of the opposite charge. So what has attracted so much interest over the last year or so about these defects is that these are deconfined and can separate freely. And so I can illustrate that with a little movie. So this is the what I was just saying. Let me rerun this. So if a running out of RAM here. So if a defect is created at the bottom here, once a defect is created and a positive charge and a negative charge is created, these can separate and there is no strain tension attached to these two charges, and these defects can propagate essentially freely. So let me. So if a spin is flipped here, so this bottom tetrahedron here as the the charge being violated, this one as a also the ice was being validated and the charge is created. But once this defect is created, then this initially terminally negated charge can now propagate freely. And on the path of this propagation, the spins get reversed, and this chain of misaligned or flipped spins that is shown here by the dashed line, this white line here, has been the infuriation of the particle physicists, been coined the name Dirac spin in the literature by analogy of the solenoid of flux that is created by the creation of monopoles in Dirac's theory for Dirac's theory of monopoles. So the experimental searches for these excitations and spinized and these deconfined objects essentially amounts to seeing experimental signatures of these Dirac spins also. And this is where I'm going now, is to so these, so the satisfaction of these isotopes can be described by an entropy Hamiltonian given by this theory, where the polarization is a divergence free field and can therefore be given by a gauge theory whose rotational gives rise to the polarization field. And so from this Hamiltonian, one can calculate the polarization correlation function. And from this correlator, one can calculate the spin correlations. And so the interesting aspect of this object is the singular nature of the spin correlation that can be observed experimentally. So let me show that. So these are the neutron scattering experiment in one of these spin ice material. And what one finds through these experiments is that through these various pinch points here, the intensity is singular depending, or regular depending on how these bright points are approached. And this is the experiment, and this is the calculation through this model with the divergent free field. And one finds that around these points here, there are these cones of intensity, where the intensity here is regular, approaching the pinch points through this direction. But if you approach it this way, it diverges as you approach in these cone-like direction. So these Dirac spins, these directions of flip spins, can be observed experimentally through the application of the field. So if you apply a field along the 1-0-0 direction in these systems, the tetrahedra obey the ice rules. We have two in, two out for each tetrahedra, but each tetrahedra is in the same spin direction. And so now the in the limit of low temperature and sufficiently small field, these excitations are dilute, and one can observe the effect of these dilute fluctuations of spin reversal directly in the neutron scattering. And so this is what it looks like. So this is a calculation of the neutron scattering intensity. It's a bit of a complicated figure because here there are several scattering planes that are shown, but the important feature is that around where there were pinch points in zero field, one finds that there's cones of weak intensity that are caused by these Dirac spins. And if you look at the experimental results, one sees regions that pretty much correspond to what is observed experimentally. So So the presence of these oriented defects, these Dirac swings in the magnetic field and spin ices have been observed quite recently. And what also has been found is that when you apply a magnetic field in these systems, you kind of promote the dissociation of the tetrahedron from the isoflame condition. So in zero field, there is a thermal equilibrium, an equilibrium of concentration of tetrahedra that will obey the isoflame to into out. And if you apply a small field, one rebalance this equilibrium and modify the concentration of defects on the tetrahedra, which where you have let's say three in, one out, and one in, three out. And so through a muon spin relaxation experiment, one can measure the rate at which a muon can relax when it connects these materials, and measure directly the through analysis the charge of these monopoles that are, or these charges that are nucleated by the application of a field. So the situation about the monopoles and the nature of the Coulomb phase in the spin ice seems to be in good shape. There is more work being done right now, experimentally and theoretically, to describe the system. The main important message is that these materials, these spin ices, are classical. They're Ising-like. They have this constrained ground state. And it seems that from an experimental point of view and a theoretical point of view, one can describe at large end scale the physics of these systems by a Coulomb phase, and one understands these the excitations out of that state by these charge-like defects. The question is now, coming back to the quantum system, can we, once we have these classical systems which have these Coulomb phase, can we find a quantum system, quantum materials, for which the one would get not the Coulomb version of these systems, but the full-blown quantum electrodynamic version of these materials, where you have not only the electric charge associated with the defects, but also the magnetic charge of the monopoles, and have full-blown emerging gauge excitations and photon-like excitations. Okay, so this brings me to the last part of my talk, the terbium titanate systems. So this is a bit similar to a lot of the work that has been done in frustrated magnetism, is to look for a material which is close to the boundary between two phase transitions. So in these spin ices, there are two phases, as I explained earlier. There is a phase which is kind of trivial, where all the tetrahedra, all the spins on a tetrahedra point in or out, and you have the spin ice. And what dictates where you are in this phase diagram is essentially the ratio of the exchange interaction compared to the dipole. Somehow, by a fluke of nature, the terbium titanate compound sits right at the vicinity of this boundary between this nail-ordered phase and the spin ice system. And this is where one might expect to see some interesting physics coming in. Yes?
Sorry, I'm a little bit confused. So you mentioned that these topological defects are monopole. The spin flips are monopole.
Well, this
can be interpreted.
Yes, it can be interpreted that way. It's kind of more of an abuse of language than anything else, I think.
Okay. But so we have magnetic charges, but where are the electric charges?
They don't exist per se in the Ising system, because there's no quantum dynamics. So the idea is to see whether or not the quantum dynamics can be found in some materials by bringing back the quantum dynamics. So in the effective theory of the system, there's no J perp. There's no raising and lowering operators that operates in the low energy manifold. So the idea, how can we get it back? And so there's no way to get it back in these materials, because all the quantum dynamics is quenched at high energy, which is even higher than room temperature. So there's no quantum dynamic. But the system is interesting because its effective low energy classical theory, so it's SZ, a Z term, is by accident of nature almost tuned to zero, because the system is right at the confining boundary between these two classical phases. So now quantum fluctuations, which would be negatively initially small, they are brought into the picture for force.
I'm trying to understand this phase diagram. So the blue dots are the phase transition line.
The blue squares, above the blue squares, you have the parametric phase. below the blue squares, you have the ice walls being enforced. It's a crossover where the
where is above. Where is the nail temperature?
The nail temperature would be on the gray line here. So you have to have a log scale to see it. So if, for example, for a given material, let's say dysprosium, that bump would be at 1.2 Kelvin, and the transition would be at a factor of 15 or so lower.
So has that been seen experimentally?
No, there's been at least half a dozen groups that have looked for that transition that's never been seen.
In any of the three materials?
No. Okay. But presumably the argument why it hasn't been seen in the classical Eisenstein ice is because the system falls out of equilibrium, and in order to reach this order state, you would need some kind of non-local dynamics, and presumably it's not acting in the real material. So the tertium titanate actually was
But why is then? Can you go back?
Yeah.
So why is terbium more quantum than dysprosium?
I'll explain.
Okay.
I'll explain. It's not obvious from this picture. At this point, I'm just saying that because we have the excretionally good the theory to describe the Eisen systems now, so we can calculate and make comparisons with the experiments. And if we apply this kind of theory to the terbium titanate, it fails completely at all levels. We can get nothing right because the classical theory just breaks down. It just it will become clear.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah.
As I see, the model remains classical because if you have to update a very long loop,
it's small.
It's
like
exponentially small.
Micro Kelvin type terms in terms of if you look for a six-fold ring. Ring exchange dynamics, it's sub millikelvin in terms of this time. So there's no tunneling going on from this time. Okay. So the point is that it's because JZ is so large compared to J per that by the time you raise up to the sixth order on an hexagon, you have nothing left. But the point is that in terbium titanate, the JZ is brought naturally to zero almost by accident. So then you can, maybe there's something interesting that can go on. Okay, so let me skip the experimental evidence. I can discuss that in private if you want. Let me tell you that after 10 years of experiments and various measurements, the QV vice temperature in terbium titanate is 20 Kelvin, minus 20 Kelvin, but down to 20 millikelvin, so three orders of magnitude in temperature, there's no evidence of a phase transition. So it's an example, one of the rare examples of a three-dimensional spin liquid. So this is the experimental evidence that there's something peculiar that goes on in the terbium titanate that there's no phase transition going on. So for example, let me just flash this. So if you look at the diffuse neutron scattering, what you see in an intensity map is a very large, broad blob of intensity. That blob of intensity develops below about 10 Kelvin or so, and it stays unchanged down to 20 millikelvin. The correlation do not grow, and there's no feature, sharp features that develop in the neutron scattering down to the lowest temperature that has been studied.
What is the scale of spin-spin interaction here?
This is somewhat ill-defined at this point. Let me say that if you... Can you just hold on? It will be, I think it will be clear in the next slide.
Okay.
So the physics is the following, okay? So where the quantum mechanics has gone, the large energy scale in this problem is called the crystal field Hamiltonian, which is, think about it as a large U problem, which you solve first. So in the dysprosium and the holmium system, these high excited states are very high energy. So one can have a theory when you project the bare interaction between the spins in the low energy sectors. And if you do that through the symmetries of these low energy crystal field states, there's no raising and lowering operators that act with that manifold. So that's why there's no quantum dynamics in the systems. But the terbium has a much more condensed set of crystal field states, and so these energy levels are much tighter by a factor of 20 or so. And if you project the macroscopic exchange and dipole interaction system through this low energy manifold, by accident it almost vanishes. And so, what's left are the virtual processes which take you from the low energy crystal field manifold to the excited states and then back down to whatever order.
So you have a two low line states. There's a splitting is a very
small. Now, I just want to emphasize that this is a doublet, but they are degenerate.
A degenerate?
That's it.
So on zero.
So the manifold states are a doublet is singlet, and the other states have high energy.
But do you have some extra mechanism to split that bullet?
No.
I see. A time reversal
simulation?
So the idea is, the following is that this splitting between the ground state doublet and the first excited doublet plays the role of the inverse of splitting, but the role like the, of quantum fluctuation. So as we move from to the holmium and dysprosium material are in this classical plane, and this terbium lives outside that plane. And so the idea is then these are the classical phases that exist, which would have various properties. So what I talked about are these spinized regimes, spinized phases. But the question is, what's happening in between where these quantum fluctuations are introduced? So is there a QED type Maxwell phase, or are there some other types of a long range order phase? This is really the question. Okay, so
what was the third axis there?
It's one of the gaps. That's the exchange divided by the gap between the two constant
dots. J-per, I should think of it as J-per.
Yes, you can see. It is J-per. So let's see which way it goes. So this is this phase diagram is a plot of what are what's the ground state of the system as a function of the exchange between the spins and one over the gap. So when the gap is pushed to infinity, this gap, the gap between the ground state doublet and the excited doublet, we are in a classical mode, if you have the ground state doublet for each ion and the first excited doublet, you have four states, you have four sites and a contrivium, so there's 256 states or so. So here, 216 of the states are at low energy, 240 at high energy. So when the exchange is small, here, the ground state corresponds to a two-not-in-two-out phase, so in a spinized-like state. But if the exchange is more antiformatic than a critical value, then you have the ground state is a doublet, which corresponds to an all-in-all-out. So if you diagonalize the Hamiltonian on a single tetrahedron, what you find is that this boundary between the ice-type phase to into out and the doublet on and on off is pushed upward. And so initially the material, the terbium titanate, was above this phase boundary, which where you would have predicted that the ground state would be an all in all out phase. But because of these quantum fluctuation virtual processes between the crystal field state, it finds itself below that boundary. And so the phase that exists now, these quantum fluctuations lift the degeneracy between the 6 2 in 2 out phase, and the real ground state is an entangled 2 in 2 out state, is a singlet with some kind of RVB at the level of single tetrahedron. So how do we understand why this boundary goes this way, as up as a function, as opposed to down? One way to do that is to do a kind of perturbation theory, digital perturbation theory, where you take the macroscopic Hamiltonian and you project order by order in the low energy subspace. And so the lowest order term, the PVP term, is the classical theory, is the Ising theory, and in the holmium and dysprosium materials, these terms are very small because the gap between the ground state doublet and the excited doublet is large, something like 3 orders of magnitude larger than the interaction. But in the terbium material, these two terms are very small, such that, and furthermore, the crystal field gap is also small, such that the quantum fluctuation term can be brought back to the picture. So if you calculate this phase diagram, you can diagonalize now the XXZmol on a single tetrahedron, you find that it agrees with the hexagonalization for a single tetrahedron. So the displacement of the phase boundary between an entangled 2 in 2 out phase and a doublet comes from these virtual processors, and this demonstrates that through these quantum fluctuation, the system is actually further stabilized in the frustrated regime. So these are the calculations that we've done on a single tetrahedron. So what we've tried to do is to push that on the lattice. So the idea is to start from the microscopic Hamiltonian do this digital perturbation theory, it's a bit difficult because you have these long-range dipole-dipole interaction, and so it's quite difficult to go even to second order in digital perturbation theory because you generate a whole pile of effective interactions with your calculation. But what you end up at the end is pretty, from a symmetry point of view, that is quite simple. You have essentially a long-range term that couples the Ising interaction. So you have, this is the spin-Ising part of the problem. And through these virtual processes, you generate a transverse term, which is responsible for the quantum dynamics. If you put numbers in now, you find that JZ is of the order of something like 100 millikelvin or so, and the transverse term are typically 20% lower. Okay, so J equip over JZ is 0.2. So, of course, it's complicated because this whole Hamiltonian is long range now. You have long range dipolar light interaction, you have 1/R6 interaction, you have first, second, and third neighbor interaction. So it's a bit complicated. So, so the first thing that we've done so far is to identify the semi-classical long-range order phase. So it's kind of interesting. Then we essentially minimize the energy of this Hamiltonian and look for the classical phases. So when the gap is infinite, there are two phases. There are this long-range order spin-Ising phase that we have found in previous Monte Carlo simulation. There's the all-in all-out phase for large exchange. And there's a whole new phase that opens up, which is another type of spin-Ising where the propagation vector is different than the one that exists when the quantum fluctuations are neglected. Of course, this is not a quantum calculation. We just minimize. It's a large S calculation. But it just gives us some guidance of what to maybe expect. Now, the paradox is the following, is that there's another material, which is tritium stannate. So we just replace this bystander non-magnetic ion, and this is where in parallel space this material is, and it turns out that this material orders to a phase transition at 0.8 Kelvin, and to an ordered phase, which is actually what we calculate. So in the canting angle that is observed expansively, so this material is a long-range ordered spin-Ising, a propagation vector is phi equals zero, and the spins are canted somewhat from the, let me show a picture, like here, this is the ground state, the spins are canted from the Ising direction, there's a net ferromagnetic moment that points along the 0, 0, 1 direction, and this canting angle is observed expansively is 13 degrees, and through this rather complicated calculation, we find that the canting angle is about 8 degrees. So it seems that we're able to capture the physics of the tritium stannate material, this material here, and the tritium titanate, which in the parameter space would live at somewhat in the same region of parameter space, expansively doesn't seem to order down to, let's say, 50 millikelvin. Yet at the level of our calculation, it'd be the same phase. So the question is, what's going on in this tritium titanate system? And more interestingly, are there quantum disordered phases, are there Maxwell phases that exist in the space diagram which somehow encapsulate the semi-classically long-range ordered phase of this material? This is a work that is in progress right now. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Yeah, so can you put up your Hamiltonian?
I didn't write it down.
The one you had anyway. Yeah, here.
Okay.
So the J, the first term, Jx, Ji, or J, that's SE2 invariant, is that correct?
Okay, so...
Is this a schematic or...?
This is an approximation because the real exchange that would act between the spins, so here this is an approximation where an assumption to start with that the interaction between the ions can be described by this SU2 term, this exchange term. But there are terms, binaries, which are a lot less symmetry, which would be more complicated. But we, through a lot of experience, there is no direct experimental evidence right now that this model fails to describe the parameter phase. Okay, so we don't have reasons to put more complicated term in the bare minimum at this moment, but they could be there.
Presumably, there's also singular isotropy somewhere. But okay.
Well, this is V. This is the interaction. The single ion terms is what gives the spectrum here from which the digital perturbation theory is done. So it's included from the word go.
So what is the deviation that you see in the experiments of Tilden Tanton from your classical simulations? So there are things that you know.
So the classical simulations predict residual entropy. It predicts a diffuse neutron scattering.
So you don't see the pinch points, for example.
No, there's no pinch points in whatsoever in the experiment, and maybe it's buried into at low energy in the diffuse scattering. But even the notion of looking for these pinch points so the quality of the measurements that were done to look for the pinch point in spinites is in no comparison compared to what was done for Tilden Tanton. It's much more high quality experiment. So
I think the corner spin liquid should also have spin points. I don't know. Pinch points in the structure factor, right?
Yes, but here this is it should be so the pinch points exist in the
at least the U1 corner spin liquid should have that.
Yes, but this is diffuse neutron scattering, and there is this was done with very low energy resolution. So the measurement that were done were energy integrated, and so maybe the pinch points, if they exist in premium titanic, are very below what was the instrumental resolution.
Okay.
So
the main discrepancy is the entropy. Nobody sees the entropy.
So it's not even clear that the specific heat between different experiments is not in complete agreement. So it's not clear that there is a residual entropy or not. So maybe these experiments probably need to be redone.
Last question.
Do you think nuclear spins and hyperfine interactions play any important role?
So the hyperfine interactions for terbium here are pretty small. If you look for a Schottky like anomaly associated to nuclear, it's probably below 15 Li Kelvin. It's probably a sub-leading energy scaling problem. But it could play a role.
Yeah. So since the scale, the scale for effective spin is only like 100 millikelvin, is that right?
That's right. By the time there's many terms in the effective theory, but all these numbers are the order of 100 to 200 millikelvin.
So what I'm trying to say is that then this neutron scattering measurement down to 50 millikelvin is not that low compared to that.
Yeah, that's it.
So whether there are some not neutron but other, say, like thermodynamical measurement, say, down to, say, even lower temperature, try to see whether it's odd or not odd. Because, say, above 100 millikelvin is really high temperature phase.
That's right.
So whether there's any experiments can even...
So that was this 100 millikelvin energy scale as arising in our big... So this argument is something that the scale of these numbers is something that has been under debate for like a number of years. People would argue that it's sort of the order of 1 Kelvin, but the point is that that this one is 1 Kelvin and this is 0. This is not valid. Right now the theory is a bit ahead of the experiment. So these low temperature measurement. Specific heat below 20 millikelvin becomes quite difficult to do. There's not too many labs that are set up to do that. And then this question of then everything gets swamped by nuclear effects below 20 millikelvin. So specific heat is difficult. Thermal conductivity has not been done, but it's being planned right now. Ultrasound, dielectrometry, and
but whether there is the measurement of a single spin flip or in a single effective spin flip, say through this inelastic neutron scattering. I mean, if there are some doubts about the theoretical estimate of coupling constant, whether there is some kind of experimental measurement. from this, from some kind of spin wave.
So okay, so something like that. So the reason that goes back to Subia's question: how do we know that this engine makes any sense to start with? So at high temperature, deep in the parametric phase at 20 Kelvin, we can do random phase approximation and fit the elastic and the inelastic Newton's coupling, and then it fits. So we have a handle on the bare Hamiltonian, which we don't necessarily have to have, but it seems that we do. But so this is a microscopic calculation. Once you give it, you accept the value for this, one just has to sit down and calculate things.
All right, let's thank the speaker again.